great American rap resurrect. Rest in peace, Young S. Born live on the set. Born live on the set. Yeah.
First off, say peace to Pine Ridge. Shame at all the damage that the white man wine did. Ghost dance, Pelletier's 5 million beers a year, and all that other crime did. More pieces to the teachers of blind kids, to red bells and small cells keeping their mind big. Say everything's hostile, suicide bombers and prosperity gospels. Emaciated models with cocaine and blood pouring out their nostrils. They got to, just to stay awake on the catwalk of life where everybody watch you. Straight hair, high heels, and a handbag. Crucifixes, racism, and a land grab. Katrina, FEMA, trailers, human body sandbags. A peace sign and a pants sag. A money toss calls a nine-stripper mad dash. A friend request following a hashtag. Now everybody wanted like the last laugh. A Michael Jackson jacket or a death mask. Purple Jordans or the mixed girl in your math class. Stable is when the bath had Baghdad. But corporate jets really had to have that gas band. War and they hope they all fall from the rat attack. Cause that's just more dinosaur for the Cadillac.
Asheville Free Media, ashevillefm.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm William Goodenough. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, and KOWALP in Olympia, Washington. For archives of the show, you can visit thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org. And to send us a message or to suggest content for the show, you can send us an email at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. We're speaking with Dan Berger, who is an author, movement historian, and anti-prison organizer. His new book, The Struggle Within, Prisons, Political Prisoners, and Mass Movements in the United States, is available through PM Press at pmpress.org.
This week's Sean Swain segment is, again, by proxy. Sean is still being denied access to telephone and to email, so this segment you'll hear this episode will be read by none other than the stimulator from It's the End of the World and We Know It and I Feel Fine.
First up, though, is a piece from comrades at A-Radio Berlin entitled Practical Self-Help, an Abortion Hotline in Chile. You can hear more of their work at aradio.blogsport.de. Many thanks to them for this piece.
Sagen Sie jetzt mal bitte,
Anarchie.
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 Ob geschichtlich oder brandaktuell,
mit Berichten und Interviews, mit Beiträgen und Collagen
beleuchtet das anarchistische Radio Berlin das Phänomen des Anarchismus.
Viva Anarquia!
In Santiago, the capital of Chile, the first anarchist book and cultural fair took place on December 1st, 2013, the Feria del Libro y la Cultura Libertaria de la Zona Norte. On this occasion, we spoke with the women's and lesbian collective Línea Aborto Libre. In the light of the absolute ban in the country on terminating pregnancies, the collective has established a telephone hotline for women who want to have an abortion, and has also published an accompanying helping hand. On the legal situation of abortion in Chile, they have this to say.
It is forbidden in every case. This means that no matter what the reason, an abortion is forbidden in every case, just like in the Vatican. The prison sentences can be up to 25 years for this, also for those who help. There is no political will to improve the legal regulation in the interests of women. For Línea Aborto Libre, therefore, it's not a question of legalizing abortion, but rather of providing information and thereby giving women the autonomy to terminate pregnancy at home. That is the message of our group. You can have an abortion at home, and very simply with 12 tablets.
En su casa, que es un poco el discurso de la línea. Voy a abortar en tu casa y con 12 pastillas.
Chile is one of the countries in which an absolute ban on abortion has been enforced to the present day. At the same time, it is one of the countries with the highest rate of terminated pregnancies in South America. Each year, between 120,000 and 160,000 women of various ages from diverse social backgrounds conduct secret abortions. In 2013, the case of an 11-year-old who had been raped caused international headlines. Out of purported health reasons, the girl was denied an abortion. The restrictive ban on abortions in Chile dates to the final days of the Pinochet dictatorship. Thus, at the end of 1989, the clause that allowed abortion at least for health reasons, or in case of rape, was eliminated. To the present, none of the following administrations has changed this regulation. For this reason, the Women's Collective prefer to rely on practical self-help.
The project is called Línea Aborto Libre, in English, Free Abortion Hotline. It is an organization of lesbians and feminists who carry a mobile telephone that women can call 4 hours out of the day if they would like information about the possibilities for drug-induced abortion. The hotline then provides women with this information. In addition to this, they get medical advice as well as tips for defending themselves against harassment in case the termination of pregnancy has to end in the hospital or emergency room.
Terminar el aborto a un hospital o a una posta de urgencia.
Since May 2009, the Women's Collective has offered an information line where they can answer all questions on the topic of abortion and how women can induce an abortion themselves with the drug misoprostol. In addition, they have also published a handbook of 120 pages.
The handbook represents an extension of the work of the collective. We either distribute it ourselves or through bookshops or libraries, which then resell it. In addition, we offer workshops. At bottom, the work of Línea concentrates on providing the necessary information on how women can have abortion with pills.
Abortion with misoprostol is among the safest methods of abortion and is explicitly recommended as a means of choice by the World Health Organization. A British study even recommends home use. In a brochure by Pro Familia that offers advice on this method of abortion, one reads that, since the introduction of the drug in the USA in 2000, there have been 9 deaths in total in connection with a uterine infection. That corresponds to 1 fatality in approximately 200,000 terminated pregnancies. Indeed, these infections sometimes also occur during births, miscarriages, or other operations. The collective orients its recommendations along the lines of the advice of the WHO. The drug misoprostol, however, was banned in Chile in 2009, and since then can only be obtained over the internet. In the handbook, there is appropriate assistance for purchasing it. In light of the difficult legal situation, we wanted to hear from the comrades whether they had also felt pressure from law enforcement on account of their work.
We had 2 charges, which, however, did not end in conviction, since the public prosecutor's office did not have adequate grounds. They could not prove that we had formed a criminal organization, which they wanted to pin on us. That, and also inciting criminal acts. But since it could not be established that the organization does those kind of things, it did not come to a conviction in either case.
The topic of terminating pregnancy is a classic taboo in Chile. The classic family model and the role of the woman as wife and mother continue to set the tone. The influence of the Catholic Church on society is enormous. For this reason, women who seek an abortion are for the most part on their own and have to fear state repression to the extent of prison sentences. Those who can afford it travel to a neighboring country to have the intervention done there in private clinics. But for many, the only remaining option is a self-conducted termination with the corresponding health risks. The resistance to these circumstances is, however, growing. Even in the presidential campaign, the topic played a role. Thus, the candidate Michelle Bachelet, since elected president, argued at least for therapeutic abortion, which permits the termination of pregnancy for health reasons. But during her first term in office from 2000 to 2006, Bachelet did nothing in this direction in any case. The general right to an abortion, as demanded by very diverse feminist groups, seems meanwhile to have receded into the far distance. The group Línea Aborto Libre describes its position in their handbook in the following way.
With the handbook, we are reacting to an absolutely moralistic society with double standards, which hides and negates the reality of the thousands of women who have abortions each day. Lesbians and feminists, we understand the exercise of rights as a praxis of liberation and of deconstruction of the ruling conception of justice. We, however, work to provide tools that women can make their decisions well-informed and independently. We do not hope for rights, recognized the state, presented as if they were a blessing. We are the ones who fight for our spaces and activities and who fill them in our daily political work by taking on a task that governments have ignored and neglected because of their lack of vision and the interest in the life of women.
The handbook goes into detail into various areas having to do with abortion, and thus also the legal framework. In particular, however, it is dedicated to the actual use of the drug misoprostol and possible options of women in hospitals. For, as one reads further on in the handbook,
abortions belong to women's everyday realm of experience. Many of us already have one behind us or still have it ahead of us, and everyone at least knows of cases in their own surroundings. Having all the necessary information on a topic enables a freer and more informed decision. This handbook describes how an abortion with misoprostol works, how it proceeds, what symptoms occur, what risks there are, and also what rights women have in the healthcare system, with the police, in the family, and in the face of the state.
We wish the group much continued success with their work. As usual, you can find the link to the Spanish language handbook and the website of the collective, as well as to other multilingual resources, on our blog at aradio.blogsport.de.
This is The Stimulator, reading a statement from anarchist prisoner Sean Swain. Okay, I've had 4 cups of coffee this morning and I came up with this plan. Check it out. We need to go from Occupy to Shockupy. Here's how we do it. Based on what I've seen in Kiev and Cairo, we in the US need to get rid of the delusional pacifist who insists on absolute nonviolence. That's the first thing. Pacifists are the reason Occupy couldn't meet state violence with equal and opposite revolutionary violence, like they did in Kiev. So, for my Shockupy plan, we get rid of the pacifists. We can get rid of them and convince them it's their idea. Check out the letter I've already written to set that in motion, which reads, "Dear people of Kiev, on behalf of the people of the United States, I regret to inform you that you aren't doing this right. You are clearly not adhering to nonviolent principles. We are sending American advisors to assist you right away. Sincerely, Sean Swain." Now, once Shockupy gets rolling, whenever we identify a delusional pacifist or protest marshal, we hand them a flyer and tell them, quote, "The people of Kiev need you." Then we give them an orange vest with USA stenciled on it, with a plane ticket to Kiev. By now, tickets to Kiev have to be cheaper than Greyhound tickets to Cleveland. We can send thousands of goofy pacifists to Kiev. And that's the last we'll ever see of them. So that's the first problem solved. Did you know that there are 48,000 homeless vets from Iraq and Afghanistan? Yeah. We can put out the invitation to them to replace the pacifists we sent to Kiev. That's 48,000 disciplined and disillusioned combat-ready resistors who know how to shoot. Also, did you know that there's more than 200 million privately owned firearms in the United States? That's far more firearms than all possible government forces combined. So, with pacifists on planes to Kiev and 48,000 homeless vets locked and loaded to help us take back the future from traitors, banksters, and profiteers, we only need to converge on one area in order to turn Occupy into Shockupy. In the last engagement, state forces could overwhelm Occupy because pacifists precluded a violent response and encampments were spread out all over the country. Members were divided. So, with Shockupy, we converge on one area, not to get newspaper coverage or hold a square until the cops show up, but with the goal of permanently liberating an autonomous zone where government collapses and the system of capital dissolves for good. Shockupy. We converge on one state, like, say, Ohio, and we outnumber state forces. Molotov cocktails, bowling balls raining from rooftops, and as Neo said in The Matrix, guns. Lots of guns. And in Ohio, it's legal. The Constitution promotes it. Shockupy. We take one autonomous zone, an area like Ohio, where rail, shipping, air, and highway transport converge. If Ohio goes off-grid, the whole country's economic system unravels. You create a major choke point and inspire further rebellions. You export disruption to Indiana, Michigan, Kentucky, Pennsylvania. You burn down civilization like the barbarians who invaded the Roman Empire and took it down by pooping in the bushes. And if the fascist forces amass enough troops to take it back, you give it up, abandon it, and gather back together in the next state over, like a swarm of locusts. A traveling flash robbery. Anyone gets captured, you liberate them. You can always find your way back to the main body of Shockupy by following the trail of burning cop cars. Shockupy, a concentration of revolutionary forces on one weak spot in the fascist order. We foraged for food at Kroger and free combat supplies at Dick's Sporting Goods. The weather is getting nicer. It all starts with a few volunteers at each university arranging for the sleeping space. Ohio has a lot of colleges with lots of dorm rooms. This would be an awesome summer for a convergence to tear down this fascist machinery once and for all. By autumn, we could be dancing naked around a bonfire where the Ohio State House used to be. From there, all it would take is 49 more cans of gasoline and a bunch of matches. Shockupy, tell all your friends. This is The Stimulator, reading a script by anarchist prisoner Sean Swain at Ohio's Supermax facility. If you can't hear the voice of Sean Swain, you are the motherfucking resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at Sean Swain number 243-205 OSP 878 Coitsville-Hubbard Road, Youngstown, Ohio 44505. To read some of Sean's writings and learn more about his case, check out seanswain.org.
Would you please introduce yourself for the radio and tell us a little bit about what you do?
Sure. My name is Dan Berger. I guess my day job is that I teach ethnic studies at the University of Washington, Bothell, outside Seattle. But I'm also a longtime anti-prison organizer, doing work around political prisoners as well as larger work against the carceral state. And I'm a social movement historian, and I've written a lot about different radical movements in U.S. history.
Is there any specific radical movement that interests you? In the book, you focus mostly on North America. Are there other movements that you find interesting to study?
Yeah, I mean, my work has really been emphasizing social movements within North America, in part because of the friendships and really kind of mentorships that I received from U.S. political prisoners starting when I was a teenager, really showed me how much of U.S. radical history was kind of hidden and buried. And so I've really wanted to re-examine and bring to light a range of U.S. radicalisms that have not been mentioned or explored or discussed in great detail. But in doing that, obviously, my kind of outlook on the world and the outlook of the movement I'm most inspired by is very global. And so I feel really inspired by a range of social movements from around the world. But for strategic reasons and sort of political reasons, I've been wanting to sort of think about how those movements have expressed themselves within the United States.
You mentioned that you are an anti-prison organizer. Would you be willing to describe your politics and talk a little bit about what projects you're involved in?
Sure. I sort of got politicized as a teenager in the mid-90s through sort of animal rights and environmental sort of eco-liberation movements. But from that point, also a time when people were being harassed and arrested and police beating up friends and folks going to prison. And so I had a kind of early education around the state. And I think that led me to anarchist and other radical movements as a result. I think for a while now, I've been sort of eclectic in my political influences, but definitely drawing a lot from anarchism and Marxist anti-imperialism, as well as feminism and queer liberation. I've been involved in a range of different groups over the years, but for the past few years was founding member of a group called Decarcerate PA, which is a campaign in Pennsylvania, where I lived for about 10 years, working to prevent many new prison construction, working to promote issues that get people out of prison and keep them out of prison, and also working to take the money and the resources that are being spent on prisons and give them back to the communities that they are now targeting.
That's really awesome. How does that redistribution of funds work usually?
Yeah, I mean, you know, right now that's been a kind of demand of the campaign, and we haven't been successful on that point just yet. But the idea is that in this time period when people talk about prisons as a necessity and a necessity made by austerity, the campaign is trying to show that there's nothing necessary or inevitable about them, and in fact that there are very concrete decisions about allocating certain resources to putting people in cages, and that those resources can and should be better spent on people themselves. So we've been doing a range of organizing in Philadelphia and across the state to make those points, and to do so specifically by targeting prison construction or attempted new construction, as well as by targeting the legislature in other ways.
Would you briefly describe your book, The Struggle Within? What led you to write it?
I first wrote part of it as an introduction to a book called That Freedom Ring that came out in 2008 and is an anthology of writings from campaigns to free U.S. political prisoners. And so I wrote a kind of introductory essay that was just trying to situate some of the movements that are described in that book within the kind of historical context, right? What are the movements that political prisoners came from? It came out and went fine. It was a great book and a great resource. But I heard, especially from a couple of friends and comrades inside, that they really enjoyed the book, but it was hard to get this kind of 800-page volume and to pass it around between them. And so there was a request to take my essay, which kind of situated some of the prison struggles in a context of wider social movements, and to make that available on its own. And so The Struggle Within was kind of born out of that process. So I took that original essay and expanded it and updated it to reflect some of the new political prisoners that have gone in, as well as some that have been released or passed away. But also, you know, when I first wrote that piece in 2007, you know, it was a really different moment around anti-prison movements and anti-prison organizing. And so it was quite exciting to go back to it now and reflect on the range of new campaigns and organizations and really just the new discussion that is happening around and against prisons, or at least against mass incarceration. And so as part of that, in addition to updating the initial text and revising the part that I wrote, we're able to bring in essays by Ruth Wilson Gilmore, who's one of the founders of Critical Resistance, and Dream Hampton, a longtime journalist and community organizer and filmmaker based out of Detroit. And to bring all that together with a resource guide so that folks reading the book can have some sense of the range of organizations that are doing work around political prisoners and against prisons and have a chance to further mobilize.
Awesome. Would you talk about the term political prisoner, which appears to be a pretty hotly debated term, at least among anarchist prison support circles in the United States? What does it mean in the context of the book? And why might it be an important distinction to draw for people?
Yeah, definitely the term political prisoner has been a contested term in different ways among different circles for a while. I think it's useful to think about folks that get locked up as a result of their work as part of social movements, as well as folks who become politicized and politically active upon their incarceration and who face further hardships and harassment as a result. And it's not to say that those are the only people in need of support, but I do think there is a difference between folks that get locked up, that get harassed and targeted for their organizing. And I think it's something that folks on the left and people involved in social movement need to pay attention to. When we look at the massive expansion of what some people call the prison industrial complex or the carceral state, this is a network of systems that was really expanded by repressing social and political revolt. And so I think it behooves us to pay attention to some of the victims of that, right, and some of the survivors of that. So I think that political prisoners, folks with quote-unquote extreme politics, and folks that are pressing for greater freedoms and justice for humanity are often the ones that the state likes to make examples out of. And so this book was trying to situate the experience of political prisoners within the movements that they come from, in part to show how that changes our perspective about mass incarceration, right, not just being about the war on drugs, but a larger effort to stop liberation struggles. And I think it behooves us to understand that the processes by which everyone goes to prison are very political. But that doesn't then mean that everyone who's in prison is a political prisoner. There are people on the inside who talk about struggling with a range of individualistic and antisocial behaviors, just like we struggle with on the outside. So I think we're all kind of shaped by political processes and political circumstances, but that doesn't mean that we're all sort of political people, whether we're inside or outside of prison. And I think that we can work toward prison abolition and towards a more radical and more just society, one where we all kind of place ourselves within it politically without trying to claim that everyone thinks a certain way or acts a certain way.
Have you ever heard the term political prisoner applied to a hypothetical person who is a more right-wing militant?
Yeah, I mean, certainly some right-wing movements also talk about their political prisoners. Once in the Pew's bookstore, I saw a book from the LaRouche movement talking about political prisoners. So it's certainly, as with anything, it's a malleable term. You know, there are lots of, not lots, but there are some, you know, fascists these days that call themselves anarchists.
Yeah, like national anarchists and...
Yeah, you know. So, you know, with any of these terms, there's no purity to be had, right? There's no guarantees that, anything is sort of holds firm or uniform across categories, for sure.
One of the most interesting for me as an anarchist was the part in your book that where you talked about nonviolence or nonviolent revolt. And you talk about the history of nonviolent revolt in the U.S. from roughly the 1960s onward. It was interesting to me because it cast nonviolence in a different light than what I typically see in the anarchist milieu. To pull a quote from page 61, quote, "Nonviolent revolutionaries disentangle militancy from violence and violence from clandestinity," end quote. In post-Occupy America, the term nonviolence has become a byword for countless other things as well, which might be like more or less distasteful to radical milieus. Would you be willing to trace a trajectory for nonviolence transforming from a widely used insurgent method to a cornerstone of liberal dogma? And could you speak about nonviolent struggle as it historically related to armed struggle?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot in that question. But, you know, I think the quote from the book that you read, part of what's important about that quote is not just the nonviolent part, but the revolutionary part. And I think the part of the genealogy that I'm sort of tracing in that section of the book is to say that there are nonviolent revolutionaries, and that being revolutionary is not the same thing as engaging in armed struggle. But it's also not to say that being nonviolent is the same thing as being a revolutionary, just to speak to some of the tensions that you're pointing to around nonviolence as a liberal dogma, or the ways that nonviolence can be used against other sort of more radical politics, the way that the kind of mantle of nonviolence can be invoked against more radical politics. But, you know, I think when we look at certainly the kind of from the 60s to the present, but also a sort of longer arc throughout history, there have been many nonviolent revolutionaries, right? People for whom the revolutionary politics are no less sincere or committed than folks that have engaged in armed struggle, but for whom they have a different strategic and or tactical analysis of what's necessary and what's effective. And I think there have been lots of really engaging and interesting actions of revolutionary nonviolence, including actions that have produced several political prisoners. There's more kind of famous examples of the sort of very scripted civil disobedience actions against the School of the Americas in Georgia or things like that. But, you know, the book is talking more about people that have dismantled nuclear weapons or other military hardware, people that have blocked military munitions from being deployed, people that broke into the FBI office in Media, Pennsylvania in 1971 and stole the files that revealed COINTELPRO were nonviolent revolutionaries. And so I think part of why I wanted to include that tendency within the book is really to emphasize that the importance is about revolutionariness, not about violence or nonviolence. The debate there is not really about violence or nonviolence. There's a debate about politics. There's a debate about hierarchy, about white supremacy, about patriarchy. That's where people are disagreeing much more than about questions of violence or nonviolence. And I think that point was really made first for me several years ago when I was interviewing Ashanti Alston, a former member of the Black Panthers and the Black Liberation Army, who served about 14 years in prison. And he really had this wonderful, expansive notion about politics and about revolutionary strategy. And he really made the point that we haven't really explored the full range of what nonviolence can do and can offer. And Ashanti is not one who would describe himself as a pacifist or a nonviolent revolutionary by any means. That's certainly not his history. But I think it is to really draw attention to the fact that if our emphasis is on revolutionary change, we should make that our emphasis. And so in my own work in an earlier book I wrote about the Weather Underground, you know, I was really surprised to find some really interesting and useful exchanges of politics and political debate between folks that we would think of as pacifists and clandestine revolutionaries, in this case from the Weather Underground, so that people like Dave Dellinger and the Berrigan brothers and other folks from the radical Catholic left were engaged in dialogue with members of the Weather Underground. And they really shared a lot politically about their opposition to war and white supremacy. And more than that, about the need for clandestine forms of struggle. so that they're having this exchange of ideas when both members of the Weather Underground and members of the Catholic Left have an underground and have a kind of underground apparatus. But whereas one was kind of waging a form of armed struggle, the other was engaging in various forms of kind of creative destruction or sabotage that, you know, were sort of nonviolent in their way. And I think that history is really important. Right? And it's not to say that that was the bulk of the nonviolent movement, you know, just like the other clandestine groups like the Weather Underground or the BLA were not the bulk of that sector of the left either. But I think among a certain kind of revolutionary left, there are much deeper and tighter connections between those that have embraced a certain kind of armed struggle, or at least who are not nonviolent, and those who are.
What's the distinction that you see historically between nonviolent and violent struggle? Because I remember a little section in the book, I think it was you were writing about the plowshares and the members of the plowshares that got the longest prison sentences, 10, 18 years, and what they were arrested for doing was destroying nuclear warhead tips with jackhammers and explosives or something like that. And I think in today's terms, I mean, especially in, like I said, post-Occupy America, that would be a really violent action, or like considered to be a very violent action. Where does the line get drawn, in your opinion, between those two forms of struggle?
I mean, a lot of the plowshares activists have stayed around after their action and have made themselves available to arrest. Whereas some of those from the Weather Underground or the Black Liberation Army or similar groups, maintaining clandestinity was an important part of their work. And so they were gone by the time their actions happened. But also, you know, there are some significant differences tactically. But I think for the nonviolent revolutionaries of the plowshares milieu, you know, they wanted to, and they did, physically destroy the weapons of war themselves. Whereas groups like the Weather Underground or the United Freedom Front, Red Guerrilla Resistance, some of the other kind of armed struggle groups of that time period who used bombs were not there. They planted the bombs and left and made sure that, for most of them, that the bombs would go off when no one was around. So both of them were interested in avoiding human casualties, but I think the groups like the United Freedom Front and so on saw themselves as part of a kind of armed struggle movement, and so certainly in their time period, there's a lot more rhetoric about people's war and violent conflict than for the plowshares, but also they weren't physically dismantling the U.S. Capitol, right? They weren't physically dismantling that police office. They were using explosives to do so. Whereas for the plowshares, I think for them, there was, for many of them, a kind of spiritual as well as political investment in, I'm going to be the one to dismantle this warhead. I'm going to do it with my own two hands. You know, possibly with my own two hands operating a jackhammer. But I do think that a lot of that difference has been sort of overplayed through rhetorical flourish, that people trying to sound very revolutionary but in very kind of dogmatic or doctrinaire ways, preventing them from seeing the great deal of convergence, of political alignment between these two revolutionary moments. Because I think there are plenty of people who don't use nonviolence as the way to write off other revolutionary sectors, right? Maybe it's something else. So I think when we shift the focus to like what is it that is most effective in building sort of revolutionary movements, that opens the door, I think, to work with people from a range of tactical, strategic, even philosophical persuasions. But when we think about we need to work only with people that believe in armed struggle or who believe in the most militant methods possible, I think that's led to some problems historically, right? Some major issues of security, some issues of sexism and heteronormativity that has led to people getting busted.
For sure. I'm also, like when you were just talking, I was also reminded of a part in the book. You make a statement that revolutionary nonviolent activists sort of bolstered armed struggle in 1970s when other parts of the left were being sort of not in my backyardish about it, being like, oh, that's okay for, you know, third world, you know, in quotes, people, but we don't want that here.
Right.
And I think it's really exciting that the two seemed to have fed off each other a little bit more than they seem to today.
Yeah, I definitely think that there are lots of people who are very set in particular mindsets and kind of wholly unaware of a range of kind of revolutionary tendencies separate from their own. I definitely think that there is a lot of rigidity among people who believed in armed struggle as well as among nonviolent folks to not see folks with other perspectives. And I think that's always been true, right, from the abolitionists forward. I guess I'm saying, like, I don't know if it's worse today, but it's definitely as pronounced today as in other periods of social struggle, for sure. And I think it really does us all a disservice.
For sure, and I think hinders the expansion of our tactical base in a way that vaguely crippling to us as strategic agents or people as strategic agents, as the case may be.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think for people that are committed to militant tactics, even up to armed struggle, we would have to face the facts that most things that most of us do most of the time is nonviolent. And that what we want, obviously, is a world that's characterized by nonviolence, that our struggles against oppression and domination and exploitation are motivated by desire for a world without those things. And so I think operating from that recognition opens up whole new sets of coalitions that I think we ignore to our own peril.
The MOVE prisoners are currently in the process of appealing for parole, or like certain members are appealing for parole or earlier releases. Could you speak to their situation and maybe give an opinion on what you think their success will be with that?
Sure. Well, just a little bit of background for listeners who don't know that the MOVE prisoners are part of the MOVE family based in Philadelphia who came together as a Black or Back to the Land naturalist type movement in the 1970s, who had a lot of struggles with the notoriously racist Philadelphia Police Department, especially at the time led by Frank Rizzo, who would go on to be the mayor. So in 1979, there was a big standoff with MOVE, where police surrounded the house where they were living and fired into the house, and there was a sort of shootout. Some MOVE members did fire back, although, you know, it was hundreds of police officers to like a dozen members of MOVE. But in the process of that, there was a police officer, James Ramp, who was killed, and 9 members of the MOVE family were arrested, and they were each charged for the death of the officer, even though it did seem that the officer was shot from behind as he faced the house, and so it seemed like it was a sort of friendly fire, so quote-unquote friendly fire. And so they were all charged as if they'd killed the officer and sentenced to 30 to 100 years in prison. 6 years later, the police also dropped a bomb. City of Philadelphia Police Department dropped a bomb on a different MOVE house in another standoff in May of 1985 and let the fire burn until it destroyed the whole block and killed 6 adults and 5 children. But since the 1979, these 9 members of MOVE have been in prison except for one, Merle Africa, who died in prison. And they've come up for parole at different moments, and they've always been denied parole. And Debbie Africa is the one who's coming up next. And the MOVE family is sort of putting out a call for people to write letters of support for her, and I certainly hope that people do. I think the parole system in this country is complicated and problematic and really based on both a certain kind of attrition that you need to show how remorseful you are for your crimes, and also a certain kind of political conservatism, by and large. And so I think that's really complicated when you're dealing both with people that are revolutionaries, but also dealing with people who may not have done the thing for which they are convicted of. So from a parole board's perspective, they don't consider it to have shown remorse if you say, I didn't do this thing. That is a sign of not expressing remorse. And that has been one of the reasons that MOVE members have been denied parole. But not just MOVE members. Many different political prisoners have been denied on those grounds. In New York, former Black Panther Herman Bell was denied parole a couple of months ago. And part of the reason that, you know, Herman's been denied several times for parole, part of the reason that they always say is that it would be a disservice to the nature of the crime, the nature of the offense, if you were to be paroled. That same logic has been used with Herman's co-defendant, Jaleel Muntakim, who's also coming up for parole in June. And again, he and his supporters are also asking people to send letters, really encourage everyone to do so. You can see more about where to do that online. But with Herman and Jaleel and with everyone else who's been denied parole on the basis of the origin of the crime or the nature of the offense, as the parole board puts it, is just another way of carrying out a life sentence. By its own standards, parole is supposed to judge your behavior in prison, right? Your sentence is your sentence, but people keep getting denied based on, quote-unquote, the nature of the offense. And that's just the way that the system is continuing to hold political prisoners, really, for forever, right? A way that they're kind of doing a backdoor life sentence. I think until we are able to effect some larger change on how parole and sentencing happen, I don't have a lot of hope that parole processes themselves will be helpful or will be successful for political prisoners. But I think that we still need to try alongside other efforts.
I agree. Are there any other kinds of cases that the state uses these sort of backdoor life sentence tactics on?
Yes. So, I mean, I think the kind of nature of the offense issue is one that the state sort of particularly uses with political prisoners and also other people who are charged with incidents involving the death of law enforcement. It tends to be a major way where that comes out. But, you know, immediately after September 11th, several longtime political prisoners, folks that have been locked up since the 70s or early 80s, were placed in indefinite isolation and held incommunicado. Folks that have been in prison for decades were just placed in isolation. Marilyn Beck, Richard Williams, Sundiata Okoli. So I think we should by now be used to these efforts by the state to further harass and marginalize and isolate and punish the people who they've already harassed and isolated and marginalized and punished. So I think that's part of why what I hope comes across in this book is the urgent need for us to take questions of state violence more seriously.
For sure, and maybe to also further think of how to best support people who may be going through those kinds of divisive and inhuman tactics, which is definitely an ongoing project.
Yeah.
We're speaking with Dan Berger about his book, The Struggle Within. More after this musical break.
You're listening to Asheville Free Media, AshevilleFM.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Burst of Goodness. How many people would it take to power the tower today? If 2,704 people donated $10, the fundraiser would be complete. If 541 people donated $50, the fund would begin. If 271 people donated $100, we could power the tower today. Today, April 27th, 2014, is just a few days from the end of the Power the Tower campaign on Indiegogo, which ends on May 1st. It's a fundraiser to pay for equipment and an antenna for Asheville FM and get us onto the airwaves of Western North Carolina at 103.3 LPFM WSFM. We just announced at the station that the Community Foundation of Western North Carolina will match any incoming donations up to $5,000 to help get this station onto the airwaves. If you appreciate The Final Straw or any of the other great programming on this all-volunteer community radio station, give back to Western North Carolina by donating to Power the Tower. Donations can be made tax-deductible. More info on that can be found by clicking the link Power the Tower on AshevilleFM.org. And check out the video to see some of the faces behind the voices you love at the station. I'd also like to take a second to announce some great news for the show. The Final Straw will be airing soon, hopefully, on WCRS LP on 102.1 and 98.3 FM in Columbus, Ohio, possibly on Thursdays at 9 p.m. If you're in that area, keep an ear out and tell your friends. And for more info on this really interesting station, check out their website at www.wcrsfm.org.
The first two chapters of your book are largely devoted to history and are entitled North American Freedom Struggles and Anti-Imperialism, Anti-Authoritarianism, and Revolutionary Nonviolence. The first chapter details struggles of Black, Indigenous, Puerto Rican, and Chicano people, and the second with the struggles of white people. In addition to the many differences between the two sets of examples, I was struck by the frequency with which people in insurgent white communities went underground after an action, only to turn themselves in to police years later. I didn't notice any examples of this tendency in the first chapter. Is this an accurate assessment, and could you speak to that some?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. I hadn't quite thought about it in those terms when writing it, but I think it is true, and I can't think of any examples from the sort of Black, Indigenous, Puerto Rican, or Chicano movement where people have gone underground and then turned themselves in years later, of which there are several examples from different kind of white left movements or collectives in that time period. What I think does happen to all movements in that history, and we saw it again recently in the Green Scare, is the problem of informants and of the people who have flipped and sort of cooperated with the state against their former comrades. And I think in the Green Scare or with someone like Brandon Darby, it's been more extreme. And I think the allure of white supremacy and white privilege has been quite strong. To some people who do that feel like there is a fold for them to come back into, that they feel like they do still have somewhere to go, and especially those who came from some kind of middle-class family background, where they have some sense of a certain kind of privilege available to them. But, you know, I think there were folks who turned faith evidence from the BLA or from the FALN, which was a underground Puerto Rican organization in the 70s and early 80s. And I think in those cases, it was often in response to extreme state violence or even torture, right? People that were bones broken, cigarettes put out on them, you know, and then denied medical coverage for weeks on end until they agreed to cooperate. So having some kind of awareness or analysis of what the state is capable of or willing to do is quite helpful. But I also think having, you know, mechanisms of support so that people know that they are able to take a principled stand without losing everything in their lives, right? Without losing their kids or connections to family and community, I think it's important. I think that's part of what has broken people or enabled people to go in another direction. I think there are some people who were underground for years and who turned themselves in later who made a strategic choice or a strategic assessment that, you know, they were no longer able to function effectively at a sort of underground or clandestine level. So I don't think everyone who turned themselves in necessarily abandoned some radical politics. I think some people went underground and to do particular work or in particular time periods, and then they couldn't do that work anymore. And so they were kind of stuck. But I think that that kind of isolation is the difference between people who feeling like they just sort of lost everything and didn't have access to anyone or anything, in which the state was able to compel them to cooperate.
For sure. Do you know what going underground can look like for people or what it has looked like in the past?
I mean, I only know what it has looked like in the past in terms of my interviews with people that have done it. You know, Bill Ayers says this in the documentary, The Weather Underground, that I thought was quite a nice way of putting it, that being underground is a state of information control, that it's not this idea of masks and wigs and funny glasses and fake mustaches, but it is about, or at least was in that time period, about, you know, being able to have some sort of control about who knows who you are and where you are and what you're up to. And obviously in the 70s, that was a whole different landscape in terms of state surveillance. So that questions of information control in that way were a lot easier to negotiate. But I think people always have to the question of how to have a steady income to survive on without being too enmeshed in certain systems that would lead to people knowing who you are.
One of the final chapters in the book is entitled Deja Vu and the Patriot Act. What can people with radical tendencies be watching out for in terms of state repression, and how would they benefit from knowing their history?
So a lot of the book is sort of addressed to that question in many respects, and I'm also just sort of finishing a book on prison movement organizing in the 50s, 60s, and 70s that definitely takes up that question in greater force. But, you know, I think part of what we see is that state repression targets the most marginalized populations, the most marginalized communities, and that includes both politically marginalized, communists in the middle of the 20th century, and anarchists and anti-imperialists in the later 20th and early 21st century, but also people marginalized by their identity and social location. So the huge, vast expanse and surveillance and crackdown on Muslim and people of Arab and Middle Eastern descent after 9/11. And I think part of why the state does this is it thinks that if it can harass and repress that most people already don't care about and don't think about, that's an easy way to kind of generalize repression to the population as a whole, right, or to society as a whole. And I think we've seen that time and time again. So I think one thing that people can learn from thinking about this history and paying attention to this history is not to necessarily run from the people or the ideas that the state doesn't like. But I think another one is that we can't necessarily run towards the ones that the state doesn't like either. And I think it requires us to have a developed and articulated political analysis and of knowing who friends and enemies are. By writing this book that tries to do a kind of brief history of a range of social movements, part of what I want to show is that the prison can be a place where a lot of different movements meet, where you see black nationalists and white pacifists and radical eco-anarchists and Puerto Rican independentistas all coming together out of an experience of kind of shared repression, shared harassment, but also in that process locating an idea, a vision of shared freedom and of shared liberation. And I think in that kind of coalition is, I think, the greatest hope that we have for the future. So not just thinking about who's already in our milieu or in our network or in our collective, but really expanding that to understand the range of people that are in motion for a better world and seeing that as our sort of natural base. One thing that I've learned from histories of doing sort of anti-repression work and my own experience of doing anti-prison organizing and political prisoner support work is that we really need everyone, or at least as close to everyone as we can get, because the state is a powerful force and repression is a sort of powerful and scary phenomenon. But when we demonstrate in our actions and in our collectivities and in our affinities that we are creating movements where everyone can thrive and flourish and be cared for while working towards a more just world, that's when I think we turn the corner, right, and when we can stop repression. For the, 16 or 17 years that I've been doing political prisoner work, I've seen a lot of really dedicated, sincere people doing the kind of daily work of supporting folks facing long-term imprisonment,
mm-hmm.
and it's hard and it's isolating, and it's so crucial that people have done that work, and I want to support them, and I want to encourage others to step into that fold. But I'll also say that I think we are living right now in a moment where issues of mass incarceration and the criminal justice system are in flux in ways that they haven't been for decades. So I actually think right now we're in a moment where it's possible to talk about political prisoners in different ways, where we can talk about political prisoners as also a part of parole reform and sentencing reform and getting releasing aging people in prison. And so to think about, you know, just as I was talking about all the kind of coalitions that can form to free people, we're also seeing at least the potential of forming a range of coalitions to turn back the carceral state more generally. So I would just sort of also want to kind of encourage people to think about getting involved both in supporting political prisoners but also in kind of larger movements against imprisonment and against the prison system at large. That's not just about supporting individual prisoners but also about shrinking the system itself.
If people aren't familiar with how to sort of get plugged in, is there a jumping board that you would recommend?
Yeah, I mean, you know, so, somewhat selfishly, I would certainly recommend the work of Decarcerate PA. The website is decarceratepa.info, and that work is, you know, obviously particular to Pennsylvania, but I think the ways that we've articulated our platform and demands are very much in that spirit of a broader movement for decarceration. I know in recent years, there's also been a group called Decarcerate Illinois, its own autonomous group, but that has also kind of sprouted up. And I think with that and groups like Californians United for a Responsible Budget in California and the Correctional Association of New York, you know, groups that have kind of maybe bland-sounding names are doing really exciting and transformative work to shrink the prison system, right, to shrink the state's ability to harass and isolate and repress. So there's not like one central clearinghouse, but I think reviewing the range of work that's happening in different state-based campaigns does reveal ways in which we can kind of think about political prisoners and what it means to free them in new and exciting ways that can also leave us in a place with at least a much reduced, if not greatly abolished, prison system.
Dan Berger, thank you so much for coming on the show and speaking with me about your book. It was a real pleasure to talk to you.
A real pleasure as well. Thanks so much for having me.
Asheville Free Media, ashevillefm.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm William Goodenough. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, and KOWALP in Olympia, Washington. For archives of the show, you can visit thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org. And to send us a message or to suggest content for the show, you can send us an email at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. We've been speaking with Dan Berger, author of The Struggle Within, Prisons, Political Prisoners, and Mass Movements in the United States, which is available at pmpress.org. For more about him and his work, you can visit danberger.org. And also for more information about the MOVE prisoners and about Debbie Africa and Herman Bell specifically, you can visit denverabc.org.
If you're in the Asheville area next Sunday, May 4th, right after listening to the show from 2 to 3 p.m., you should swing by the Mothlight in West Asheville and check out the Asheville FM open meeting. Hear about our fundraising initiatives, how they've been going, come and listen to announcements about the new shows at the station, meet volunteers, and potentially sign up to become a DJ at the station. Check out ashevillefm.org and look at all of those empty slots in our schedule that you could be helping to fill with your imagination. But, well, not with your imagination. Because it'd be real life. Well, it wouldn't be real life, it'd be radio. But, you know. But be a DJ. Right now, we're hearing a scene from their 2013 demo album. This is a 4-track from that album. More from the Kansas City, Missouri-based band can be found at ascene.bandcamp.com. Stay tuned for the afternoon music rotation.